This Power Smart Play brought to you by...
We sampled it from him, but it's not the same baseline.
You can get in serious trouble for copyright infringement.
You got an organ going.
Yeah? Copyright is not doing crap!
Copyright? What's copyright?
It's the right of the owners to control.
Right now!
You know what time it is.
Welcome to
the copyright
experiment.
Welcome to the Copyright Experiment here on CITR 101.9. You're here with me, DJ Mochi, and
me, Autonomy.
We are planning to have a short talk segment and then play some bumping tunes for you,
as we do every week on the Copyright Experiment. What are we talking about today, Jeff?
Well, we're talking about in the third part of our sort of series of comparisons with music copyright. We're talking about trademark
and
trade dress
and business patents and patent law.
We already touched on patents a little bit in more computer science sense in our first week of this.
Went through the basics of patent law there, but we're also going to be talking about chemical and biological patents today.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be exciting.
More academic endeavors, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
You want to talk about, the reason we're talking about trademark also is because something happened this past weekend that we just like couldn't pass up from talking about. What happened was over the weekend, this thing showed up in Los Angeles. You might have heard about it on social media if you're up on Twitter and stuff.
Or seen it in people's selfies, as they're unfortunately called.
Is that happening?
Yeah.
I didn't know people were taking selfies of it. Yeah, okay, so what we're talking about is this thing that popped up in LA, a shop called Dumb Starbucks. And it looks exactly like a Starbucks in every single way.
They just stuck in the word dumb.
Yeah, they just put the word dumb on top. So if you go Google Dumb Starbucks, you can see pictures of it. But
and it's an artistic endeavor.
It's being covered as that. I'll let this video explain it for you.
President and founder of Dumb Starbucks, a brand new coffee experience located in Los Angeles, California. By adding the word dumb, we are legally allowed to use the coveted Starbucks name and logo because we've fulfilled the minimum requirements to be considered a parody under U.S. law. We have a full menu including all your favorite Starbucks items, a delicious selection of pastries, and even some music for the ride home. Many of you probably know me as a comedian, but this is no bit or joke. This is a real business I plan to get rich from. But I need your support. Our flagship store is located at 1802 Hillhurst.
Okay, so that's Dumb Starbucks, their bit. The reason I'm interested in it is because of their explanation of, or their rationale for it. And so far they haven't really gotten into trouble because on the first weekend they actually were just giving away coffee. But in their frequently asked questions page, they say by buying coffee there, you're actually buying a piece of quote unquote art that they are selling you directly. And that their business is actually a parody, and that their parody is covered under, U.S. law as being legal. There's a problem with that, which if you know anything about trademark law and copyright law, then you'll see it.
To be fair, I didn't know anything about trademark before I read about it, so.
Okay, yeah.
Don't feel bad about yourself if you didn't know.
So you probably heard us on the show if you've listened before talking about fair use in copyright, and fair use is a defense you can use if you're infringing on someone's copyright. You can invoke fair use as a way to prevent copyright infringement. So fair use is a way, and one of the ways that you can invoke fair use is by creating a parody of something that's copyrighted. So parodies are allowed to be made. Even if they actually make money, which was the case with Two Live Crew back in the 70s. So if you make a parody of something, you're allowed to put it out there and you won't get sued because it's not copyright infringement. And that's what this guy, Nathan Fielder, who is a comedian, is trying to claim. But he is mistaken because he's not actually violating the copyright of Starbucks. He's violating their trademark. And trademarks are a different section of intellectual property law, which have different rules that govern them. And in trademark, such thing as fair use in trademark, but it's defined differently, and it doesn't actually cover parodies. So you can't actually use a trademark for your own purpose and call it a parody, which is what he's doing.
Yeah, because if you think about it, the incentive for an artist to do parodies, you know, it gives creative commentary and some kind of discussion sort of speak, and yeah. It furthers that endeavor. But in a marketplace like this, it doesn't really do much. It just kind of rides off their name, and then
parody is kind of a creative thought piece, right? It's mm-hmm. It's contributing to the creativity of the scene, but in trademark, the point of a trademark is to allow businesses to have specific branding that isn't able to be co-opted by other businesses.
Yeah, an exclusive branding.
Yeah, which is fair. But in this case, Dumb Starbucks, if you watch the video, is clearly taking all the iconography, the typography, the music.
It's really funny, though.
Yeah, go look it up. It's really funny. And they're clearly capitalizing on that brand awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I want to explain a bit about fair use with trademark law and how it differs from copyright law. Fair use for trademark law, there's really only a couple ways that you can invoke it and be allowed to, you know, violate a trademark. And mostly that's through having your trademark become common usage. So if for example, in the case of Xerox, because they're the first company to create photocopiers, the photocopy itself was often referred to as a Xerox. And if you're old enough, you probably remember that. But so Xerox, they didn't lose their trademark, but it effectively made it useless because people were allowed to use the word Xerox to refer to just a photocopy rather than the company. And so that's a fair use of a trademark. The other fair use is using what's called a nominative sense of the trademark, which means you're only referring to the trademark insofar as you're used to convey some other point or communication to someone.
Yeah, it's kind of like you need to say the name to convey to someone what you're talking about.
Right.
And so you use it fairly in that sense.
Yeah, or if you're comparing it to something else in discourse, then you're allowed to use the trademark.
Mm-hmm.
So, which makes sense. It's a lot more straightforward than fair use in copyright law, that's for sure.
Yeah. And I kind of want to backpedal and talk a little bit about just kind of the history of trademarking and some of the basic terminology and stuff like that.
Sure.
And how it gets registered. So, firstly, there's two main types of trademark in at least the U.S., and that is there's an unregistered trademark, which is when you see TM. And there's a registered trademark, which is when you see the R with a circle around it. And basically registering it gives you more protection and more ability to sue people and, you know, get legal action. But you can still pursue legal action in the U.S. and Canada without having registered your trademark. And what you're basically hoping to fight against is brand piracy, which is, you know, unlicensed reproduction or, you know, people piggybacking off your name or whatever. But trademarks can be licensed. That's something that some people do, you know. So if you want to have someone else share in some of that branding or whatever,
I think that often happens when you're putting the manufacturer of something on as like a component of your product or something.
Absolutely, yeah. Like I think of technology, I see that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see like Intel Inside kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Like, that's perfect for both parties, really. And sort of how trademarking came about. Started a long time ago with the Roman Empire when blacksmiths would brand their swords with their names.
Really?
Supposedly, this is what Wikipedia told me, which is the source of all true knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, it would sort of like give them, you know, like, so you see this one trademark, you think, okay, this is gonna be a good sword or something. You know, it's kind of that idea that each person has their own unique exclusive thing, which gives people an idea of what they're getting already. And then under King Henry III in the 13th century, the Parliament of England passed a legislation requiring bakers to uniquely brand their bread, or the packaging, I imagine. And so that was kind of a similar thing. And then sort of in the late 19th century, trademark laws kind of awkwardly bumbled into place. And by the end of that, you know, they were there for the UK and the US, and they've since been modified and changed. And one major example, at least in the US, is a case between Abercrombie and Fitch and Hunting World. And now they have an actual thing that they call the Abercrombie criteria, which is basically telling you if something's trademarkable, if something is, if it falls into these categories, basically. And what they are is, first of all, there's something that's inherently distinctive marks. So those are immediately registrable as trademarked things. And that's like something that's totally different from anything else. You know, it's not just like a bird. It's like some weird creature, you know, something that, you know, has no resemblance to anything else. There's no problem with trademarking that. Arbitrary marks. So a good example of this is like Apple. Apple has nothing to do with computers. It's completely arbitrary. So that's trademarkable right away. Suggestive marks. And this is where it starts to get a little hazier. It's like, for example, like Blu-ray, there's like something suggestive of what the technology is, but it doesn't really exactly say what it is. And it's not entirely arbitrary. And those are registrable as long as they're not too purely descriptive. So if you have something that says like, I don't know, spinning disc turntable, like that's not really trademarkable because it's just right. Describing what it does. And that gets me to the next category where basically descriptive marks aren't allowed unless they're shown to be distinctive somehow. So like there's a company called Electronic, which made electronics, and they weren't allowed to have their trademark, or at least not have it registered, because it was just kind of describing what they do. It wasn't distinctive. It wasn't, you know, unique enough, I guess.
Electronics with a weird accent.
Yeah, exactly. And then of course generic terms can't be afforded legal protection. And this is referring to things like for example, if you had a company that was making bread and you were in Seattle and you call yourself Seattle Bread Company, that doesn't really mean anything, you know. Right. It's
not distinctive.
Yeah. So while the name is maybe unique to your company, it can't be trademarked and registered because it's not distinct. It's just what it is.
That, and I guess that would also include like the packaging of, for example, no name products.
Yeah.
Which are just plastic wrap.
Yeah.
Or colored fruit edibles.
Yeah. Sorry, and that's actually an even better example of generic things that can't be copyrighted because it's not a, you know, it's nothing special. However, distinctiveness can be acquired over time. So there are some things which start off not being distinct, and then they kind of become their own distinct thing. And then they can register for a trademark later on. And in the U.S., at least, this all goes through the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And then sort of another thing that goes through that also is trade dress, which is like trademark, but it's kind of just like the packaging and like the non-functional components of what something is marketed with, you know, physically on the superficial side of things. And it's starting to become an issue even in like the design of websites. So you can actually get sort of a trade dress registered for a website if it's unique enough, it's just distinct enough. It kind of falls into the same categories by precedent.
It's kind of an aesthetic protection for businesses.
Mm-hmm. So if you market something, you know, in a special way that isn't just functional, that you can have some kind of protection for that.
That's interesting. That kind of starts to straddle the line of, or nearing the controversial debate in pretty much all intellectual property law, which is how vague can you make something and still have it protected?
Absolutely, yeah.
It would be pretty obscene to see something like a website layout trademarked or trade trusted, where you have like a menu at the top,
yeah.
Sidebar on the side.
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, it has to be distinctive enough, you know.
Right, yeah.
It can't just be like everything else, and then you decide to be the one that gets the trade dress register this.
And that's the fine line that exists in trade dress, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And that's where all the lawyers and laws and legislation come in to sort that out to some degree. Part of it just has to be people being reasonable, but, you know.
Right. You know, is the kind of the aim of law, but, you know, as we've shown, not always happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's kind of a quick overview of trade dress and trademark and how it works. And this is misinformation is mostly about the U.S. Some of it's Canada as well, but it's all very, very closely similar. And actually most of the world is modeled after the U.S., not to be American-centric, but that's how, that's
yeah.
how it is.
And, well, and the U.S. system is also of pretty much their entire intellectual property law is pretty much modeled after, you know, like things like the TRIPS agreement,
yeah.
where which is a international treaty signed by multiple countries, that mostly Western countries, that agree to model their intellectual property laws off of basic principles.
Mm-hmm. And sort of speaking of intellectual property laws, you wanted to talk a little bit about sort of like academic patents and things like that, or?
Yeah, so one thing that's really becoming an issue now are two academic disciplines are like chemical patents, which aren't actually patents over and above a regular patent. They're just regular patents, but for when you're patenting chemicals, there's a lot of controversy around that, and also biological patents. And so I'll start with the chemical patents. But so chemical patents are basically what the pharmaceutical industry tries to claim whenever they develop a drug, and that grants them the 20 years of exclusive sale of that drug, which is how long patents last for. This is basically the only reason that the pharmaceutical industry exists right now, and that's because by granting them exclusivity, they're giving the companies an incentive to actually develop drugs, a monetary incentive. And but it kind of comes into clash with another social aspect, which is, you know, just the health of the society. And this kind of is similar to how in music we have business interests and we have artistic interests. In chemical patents we have, and biological patents, we have business interests and health interests. So because developing a drug is so expensive, and actually drug development is now for major averages around $5 billion per drug sent to market. That's billion with a B. And to put that in context, that's more than twice as much as the cost of the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics. So,
holy cow.
Yeah. It's a lot of money to put a drug to market. And the reason is because it's really, it's difficult to develop them, but then it's also difficult to test them because the testing is so rigorous. Mm-hmm. And it should be, because, you know, this is the health of people that you're taking into consideration. But it also means you have to do so much testing before it can be released. And then you have to monitor people afterwards for side effects. And the development costs are really expensive because scientists are brilliant people. And they require expensive lab equipment, and
good pay.
Yeah, so $5 billion basically is it only takes about $500 million to develop a drug, but for every drug that makes it to market, for the big companies anyway, there's also a dozen or so that don't make it to market, and those may be scrapped early on, or they may be scrapped during like the human trial testing. Everything may have been fine in the development, everything may have been fine with animal testing, but then as soon as it gets to humans, then it just doesn't work at all, and the side effects are too great. So, it sounds like it's a really frustrating business, and it's one that it doesn't seem like a very stable business, because when you're dealing with science, nothing about the business of it promises success.
Yeah, and that's kind of a third player in that business versus health, is the business versus health versus sort of scientific academic interests.
Right. So, the scientists actually want to push the envelope forward. And that's why actually patents are helpful in the pharmaceutical industry too, because you have to disclose what you found. You have to mm-hmm. actually make the information that you've made for your private company public. And that kind of can push the state of, you know, health technology forward. So it's helpful, but it also makes pharmacy a really lucrative business. And for instance, like a drug that gets to market that may cost $5 billion, because you have 20 years of exclusivity, you can make like $20 billion.
Yeah.
And so that's a huge profit margin. And so the debate is whether, it's a complicated debate, and there's not really a clear answer, but it's whether, you know, the patent system that we have in place is, whether it's worth it for companies, first of all, and whether it's worth it for individuals, because it makes The high development costs make the drugs cost a lot of money too, and that drives up health costs for everyone. So yeah, there's not really an answer to it, but it's something that I think everyone should at least have a knowledge about. And it's very similar actually in the biological patent world, except the major controversy there is that is whether it's even ethical to patent a biological process, whether it's, because there's a few arguments against it, and one being that a biological patent is inherently based on nature, and patenting something based on nature patent system was never really made to cover natural things, and we talked about that in software last week, or 2 weeks ago, when we discussed that, you know, software often wasn't patentable for a long time because it was just a representation of math, which is just natural law. And so by patenting biological nature, then you're running the risk of putting control on life and the things that just people rely on naturally. And this is a big problem for Western companies that are patenting things that they make and then selling it to third world countries that don't really have a strong understanding of intellectual property law, or don't reap the rewards as much because they're just simple farmers and they send all their crops over for manufacturing to Western world or something.
Yeah, and not only that, but I mean just the idea of patenting something that is natural kind of goes against, in my mind, the idea that, you know, you've actually created something that's, you know, yours to patent. You know, like if I pick up a rock that it looks a cool way and I say, oh, this rock is really good, like, well, I found this one, and like maybe if I just polish it a little bit, then I can patent it. Like, that seems silly to me because like it doesn't really belong to me, it wasn't mine to begin with. I just kind of like twisted it in the right way to make it work for me.
And yeah, and so that the line that exists in all intellectual property is, you know, how much do you have to change it for it to be, how much do you have to, how much of your own kind of addition has to be there in order for it to be patentable or copyrightable or trademarked. And
that's a common theme.
Yeah, that's what we're finding happens in every area of intellectual property. But, you know, there are also arguments for patenting biological instances because, I mean, just like in chemical patents, there needs to be a financial incentive to innovate in that field because we are coming up to things like food crises and climate change, which is going to really change the natural lay of our of how we get food, how we exist in nature, and having new technology to kind of harness nature for greater purposes is kind of necessary with a changing world.
Yeah, and I think kind of just this is more abstract, but I mean, if you think about a biological copyright and chemical copyright aren't really that different. I mean, biology is just a set of chemicals,
right?
So I mean, you know, again, there's a line to be drawn there as well.
Yeah, and then with also patents, you're forcing people to disclose information publicly, push the state of innovation forward, and also it allows you to hold companies accountable for things that they have under their patent portfolio. So if we didn't have a patent system for biological systems, then we would basically be encouraging companies to go their own way and just develop things in secret and use it how they want, but never actually disclose any of it to anyone. And it creates a kind of a evil hideaway, evil genius kind of company.
Yeah, I can see that going dystopian very quickly.
Yeah. So, striking the balance is also necessary for biological patents as well. It's not really enough to say, oh, because it's natural, we shouldn't patent it.
Yeah, absolutely. There, it's more nuanced and complex than that. Mm-hmm. There's much more, very, very large consequences, it turns out, you know, like you're saying with that sort of evil corporation model. I mean, that's something that would happen, you know, you see people that they do anything to get a competitive edge, right, including, you know, potentially putting people's lives at risk.
And it does happen, and we do see it happen because there are pharmaceutical companies that have really strict business practices that they put their business ahead of their, you know, the health concerns priority. Mm-hmm. And in the biological world, there are companies that put their business concerns above, you know, the maintaining the environment in which they create things, or the ethics of manipulating genomics and stuff like that. And so there are big companies, I'm not going to name any, but anyone who knows anything about genetic modification knows that there are big companies that have really come under fire for disrupting the natural state of like ecosystems with their products. And that's really a case of, you know, you can't, when you look at that example, you can't really throw out genetic modification and biological patenting on its own, right? You have to, because there are great things that come out of it, and it's not inherent in that practice that you're going to be disrupting the environment or the ecosystem.
Yeah, you can't overgeneralize that.
Yeah, so you really have to kind of just give incentives to, for people to have real, for companies to have, you know, responsible practices that, you know, contribute to the wealth of the people who are using the products, rather than the wealth of the executives.
Yeah, I think this is a little off topic, but I think that's a great point that, you know, it's not about forcing them and, you know, boxing them to doing the right thing. It's, or, you know, whatever the right thing is. It's about giving them incentives to maintain the health and well-being and, you know, mm-hmm. whatever kind of things we're...
When there's a healthy society, everyone benefits.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that kind of wraps up our talk for today. Before we go to the break, though, we want to talk about FunDrive a bit.
Yeah. So FunDrive is our... It's yearly, right?
Yeah.
Once a year, yeah. It's our yearly fundraiser for CITR, this radio station, the one you're listening to, the one that's awesome and wouldn't exist without your help. And so we're asking once again for that help. And this time in a monetary fashion. And so we're asking you to donate. It's happening, what's it starting?
The week of February 27th to, I think, the 4th or something like that? The 7th?
Yeah.
It's the 4th? Yeah. So our show in that week is on February 27th, the kickoff day. Kicks off at 5 o'clock on the 27th. So we're one of the first shows in the Fun Drive. And so we're just kind of giving you a fair warning right now for that show. If you like our show, if you think it's valuable, if you want to support it, we would be forever grateful. And you can donate to our show on air on Thursday, February 27th. So yeah, get that pocketbook ready.
Yeah, and we'll send out, you know, over the air, we'll tell you where to go. But also we'll post a link onto our blog beforehand. And that's going to be at copyrightexperiment.tumblr.com, where we also, you know, post all of our music and past shows and everything.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you like the show, if you like the station, please support us.
If you just like public radio in general,
mm-hmm.
support
that
it.
Too. It's a valuable stuff. Resource for a world that's dominated by skewed media, for sure.
Yeah, canned. Anyway,
yeah, if you don't like the radio voices, support community radio.
This summer on CITR. So we'll be right back. This has been the Copyright Experiment on CITR 101.9. Finishing up our talk segment and jumping into some tunes. What's first off, Tim?
The first track is Revy DeVito.
Revy DeVito. Oh, we played it a little while back. She's
yeah.
cool.
Yeah, another track here. I'm doing a mix of... slow jams, kind of sexy love tunes, get you in the mood for
gross.
Valentine's Day tomorrow.
Get out of here. Oh, God, fuck that.
I guess we have differing views on
Well, you were in different places, you know. Yeah. Alrighty.
You can enjoy the tune still.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Dun, 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 dun. GOSA, the Global Outreach Students Association, offers students the chance to learn about global health and international development while providing students with opportunities for practical experience working within disadvantaged communities both locally and internationally. They also collaborate with other clubs to organize global health-related symposiums and competitions. Executive positions are available. Contact them at ubc.gosa@gmail.com.
Hey, this is Noah from Christ on Parade, and you are listening to...
What's up, guys? This is Pete from Small Town DJs. Thanks for listening to the best of 2013. Unfortunately, due to copyright, we had to pull it off SoundCloud, but you can still download it below via Facebook or stream below via Mixcloud.
Thanks for listening. So that was just a little snippet from Small Town DJs SoundCloud. I thought that was kind of interesting that they had to remove their best of 2013 because of copyright. SoundCloud exerting their control. Anyways, everything
they
we play.
EP out on Fool's Gold for free.
Yeah. So, yeah, Small Town DJs just got an EP out on Fool's Gold for free. Are we going to play any tracks from that this week?
Maybe, if we have time.
Yeah, if we have time, we'll play some. If not, next week. But unlike SoundCloud, Tumblr allows us to post all of our tracks for free for you to download. Mm-hmm. So check it out. CopyrightExperiment.tumblr.com. Let's get right into this, eh? You ready, Tim? the Dream. I Love Your Girl. Arnold on the remix. Before that was Sweetest Taboo, produced by B. Bravo. Rev DeVito on the lyrics. For You Love by Jordan Loughborough, produced by Canadian Echo. Echo's the name, Canada's where he lives. Before that was Kleindel, Want You Back. After all, the time we had, man, she went with your dad, felt like a king, even when I drove you mad. Hotel down. Sorrow's house, now falling down, now falling down. free download from Low Indigo. Track called All Animals 7 AM. Sorry, that's 7 AM by All Animals. Seriously sexy up in here. You know this one. Jeremy. All the Time featuring Lil Wayne right here. Natasha Mosley, produced by FKI. I make them pussy lips drool. She got that junk in the trunk. You know I like junk food. I tell her like this. Life is good. We'll be right back. Birthday Sex by Jeremy again. Before that, we had Feel by Awkward Drop and Big Fish. And this is a Hovatron remix of Jeremy. It's Jack Green's old name. Rihanna and DJ Sicko to one.
You go. 10, so a bitch does it right. Piss on you bros like a dog on a lawn. 40-inch weave with a golden thong. Who getting money over here? Put your hands up. Who's getting money over here? Put your hands up. Who's getting money over here? Put your hands up. Put your hands up. Who's getting money over here? Put your hands up. Who's getting money over here? Put your hands up. Who's getting money over here? Put your hands up. Put your hands up. Enter the scene with a $1 billion dream and a pocket full of sheen. Yes, that bitch looks fearless. Can you feel this beating on your drum? Rubber pump pump, make a fat bitch come, nigga. This pussy delivers same movie bricks out of $1 million clips. So you wanna be rich? Munch on this fish as I rub on my tits.
Broke ass, motherfucker, happy making record niggas who ain't getting money right now. Fuck all y'all.
It's all about being ugly right now.
It's all about being ugly and getting this fucking money.
I keep the coins in the safe, coins in the safe, coins in the safe, and a knot on my waist.
I get this fucking money.
A million a day, yo. A million a day, yo. A million a day, yo. I could put Jesus on the payroll.
I get this fucking money.
I keep the coins in the safe, coins in the safe, coins in the safe, and a knot on my waist.
I get this fucking money.
A million a day, yo. A million a day, yo. A million a day, yo. I could put Jesus on the payroll. Piranhas on the lawn, about to act up, better call the guards. She's trying to catch a fit, I better got a perm that'll make her acid, nigga. Got the juice for that ass, about to send a clap to your face first class. Bitch, I ate the song in a 40-inch weave and a golden bong. Coins, diamonds, jewels, girls. Coins, diamonds, dollars, pearls. Coins, diamonds, jewels, girls. Bitch, I own the world. I keep the coins in the safe.
Coins in the safe, coins in the safe.
And a knot on my waist.
I get this fucking money.
A million a day, yo.
A million a day, yo.
A million a day, yo. I could put Jesus on the payroll.
I get this fucking money.
I keep the coins in the safe.
Coins in the safe, coins in the safe.
And a knot on my waist.
I get this fucking money.
A million a day, yo.
A million a day, yo.
A million a day, yo. I could put Jesus on the payroll.
Lost in this mix, forgot to do track IDs. Tommy's killing it. This is a self-evident mashup of Sex on Fire with Level 9. Before that, we heard Bryn Mawr, a track called Payroll, Feet Galore off of his new mixtape. Before that was Never End, Cuffed Remix. That's Future and Kelly Rowland. Can't get enough Jeremy. Can't get enough birthday sex. This is Rhythmicon on the remix this time. Rhythm of Corn, sorry. Vancouver local 2222. Track called My Vision off of Drip Recordings promo. Vancouver. What's up? My Vision. This is Self-Evidence label. Big fans of him here. This is gonna be our last track for the evening. You can download this and all of our other tracks we played tonight at copyright experiment.tumblr.com.